God's dream home. This is about the setting for Revelation 21 and 22. I'm going to talk about it a little bit, but mostly not. But we'll begin with two verses from Revelation 21, and then we're going to go back to Genesis and take a quick tour through the Bible. And next week, we're going to finish this up in Genesis 21 and 22. People sometimes imagine a dream home. Some people do that quite a bit. If you had a dream home, a place, what would it be like? Where would it be? Where would this home be? You picture a setting. What would the actual building be like? That's what I mean by a dream home. David S. builds custom homes. And for some of those people, he's building their dream home. They pick the land, they pick the house plan, and so on. Usually we find out we can't quite afford our dream home, so we do something a little less. That's how we operate. We cut back a bit. Think about God imagining his dream home. We're watching God, and he's daydreaming. He's daydreaming about his perfect home. What's going on in his mind? When God thinks about his favorite place, what's he thinking about? Where would God like to live forever? We sometimes wonder what heaven will be like. I'm coming at this a different way. We think heaven will be like this or like that. I hear about that once in a while. So imagine God imagining heaven. God's thinking about heaven. Heaven will be like this. What's he picturing? What's God looking forward to? He is looking forward to something. The Bible answers this fairly clearly. And he's got a project going that we actually don't care about. We assume God's business is to take care of our projects. God has a project going. Revelation 21, 2 and 3. Revelation 21, 2 and 3. This is what God imagines his dream home to be. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, that's behold, people, pay attention. God's dwelling place is now with the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. God's dream home is people. Look around. This is very much like his dream home, these people. The word with occurs three times in that sentence. God's dwelling place is now with the people. He will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them. God's dream home is his people, living with his people, being in the middle of his people. When God imagines heaven, he imagines being with his people without any kind of restriction. And we think, really? That's it? We, ourselves, people like this, only a lot more, this is God's dream home? How can that be? Surely he can do better. What's so special about us? Which is the right question. I don't really know the answer to that, except what's special about us is that God made us to be his dream home. That's the way it started. He made us to be his dream home, and then he lost it. And he's been rebuilding it a long time. And what we call heaven is God moving into his dream home. And these people here are his covenant people. Besides saying three times that God will live with us, this line also says they will be his people, and he will be their God. God's dwelling place is now with the people, and he will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be with them and be their God. So God's dream home is covenant people, people who love him and thank him and serve him. That's God's dream home. He actually has a lot of trouble arranging that. He actually has a lot of trouble arranging people who love him and thank him and serve him. But nevertheless, that's his dream home. So now we're going to go back to the beginning of Genesis and see how that's been a teaching of the Bible right from the start. So now we're going to go to the Garden of Eden. I'm not going to read very many texts here. You could take a look at Exodus 25. Oh, Genesis 6. There's lots of texts. Genesis 6 is the next one I'm going to read. So God made Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. And we read in Genesis 3 that it was God's habit to come in the garden every day and walk with those people. See, the Garden of Eden was for people, and God was with the people. So the garden was their home, but that was his home. He put people in a good place, and then he moved in, and that was his home. And when Adam and Eve sinned, when the human race rebelled against God, God put them out of the Garden of Eden. And on that day, it was like God's home burned down. He had made himself a very fine home. He built a home for himself, and in one day, it self-destructed. He lost it. In the morning, he had it. At the end of the day, it was gone. He had no home. Because he had no covenant people. And there was pain. And for the woman, children would bring pain. For men, work would bring pain. That's in Genesis 3. We read about God's pain in Genesis 6, the beginning of the flood story. The Lord saw how great humanity's wickedness had become. The Lord was grieved that he made people on the earth, and God's heart was filled with pain. See, when we have pain, we're grumpy at God because he doesn't fix it. And the idea that God is also living with steady pain does not occur to us. God is not a whiner. We don't read about this very often. But there are a few places we get very clear indication of this. And this is one of them. So, God's heart is filled with pain and he has lost his home. That's part of it. Because the people, his home is the people. And the people are just getting worse and worse. We're going to talk about the tabernacle. When people lose everything in a disaster, when a home burns down or a flood destroys it, we usually start to rebuild. We do that because we're made like God. And that's what God did. He started to rebuild. So he began to create a people who were not rebels, who would trust him and serve him, covenant people. So this actually started with Abraham, but we're going to skip to Exodus 25. I'm going to read 25:8. So God went to Egypt and he rescued Israel out of Egypt and brought them to himself out of slavery across the Red Sea. And God made a covenant with them. They said, I will be your people and you will be my God. So he makes this arrangement with them. And so he will take care of us and his people will honor him and love him and serve him. That's in Exodus 24. And now I want you to read 25:8. Let's read 25:8. Have the Israelites make a sanctuary for me, and I will dwell among them. God is trying to fix what happened at the garden. That's what he's trying to do. He's trying to fix what happened at the garden. And so as soon as he has a covenant people, he says, build a place, and I'm going to move in. And basically, from chapter 25 to chapter 40, Israel is building a sanctuary for God. Now let's read, go to Exodus 40 and verse 33. Exodus 43, this is the very end of Exodus. Exodus 40, verse 33. Then Moses set up the courtyard around the tabernacle and altar, and he put up the curtain at the entrance to the courtyard, and so Moses finished the work. And then the cloud covered the tent of meeting, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. Moses could not enter the tent of meeting because the cloud had settled on it, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. I want you to see in the progression a little bit of impatience here on God's part. He's like a young groom who does not want to wait after the wedding. So it took him a long time to get those people out of Egypt to Mount Sinai and to make the covenant. But as soon as the covenant was made, he said, now you're going to make a house and I'm going to move in. There was no dawdling between the end of the covenant and the house project starting. And then it took them a long time to build their tabernacle. There's 14 chapters there. But as soon as Moses is finished, God moves in. And we sort of lose this. But this is the thing that happens at the end of Exodus, where God moves into the tabernacle. That is the first time God has lived with people since the Garden of Eden. There's big progress there. God has not been, he attends to Abraham and so on. But this kind of language with God moving in does not come in between there, between the Garden of Eden. God is trying to fix what happened at the Garden of Eden. He's beginning to rebuild his house. And now I want to point out some details about the tabernacle and furniture to show that it connects to Eden and to the holy city in Revelation 21 and 22. Cherubim. Cherubim are angels with wings. Most angels actually in the Bible don't have wings, though we always picture them that way. But cherubim are the few angels that actually have wings. And in the Garden of Eden, when he kicked the people out, when they were banished from the garden, who guarded the door? Cherubim. The cherubim are God's guards. When God built the tabernacle, there were cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant, and the curtain had cherubim interwoven with it. Actually, in Revelation, the four living creatures with all the wings, six wings, that's cherubim. That's what we're getting. This is what God's dwelling is like. And so the tabernacle is like the garden in that way. Now, there was a gold table in the tabernacle that always had bread and wine on it. We're going to have the Lord's Supper later today. This is part of the presence of God. But bread and wine come from a garden. And it's a sign that where God lives and where God's dwelling with his people, there's lots of food. The lampstand. There was a golden lampstand in the tabernacle, which we call a menorah. It had a main stem and six branches, seven lamps. And the lamps never went out because there is light in the presence of God. And the curious thing about this lampstand is that these golden branches are not just pipes. They are full of golden flowers, golden buds and blossoms. That whole lampstand is basically a fruit tree bursting with life. It's all gold, but it is shaped full of golden flowers, buds and blossoms. It's a tree bursting to life. Can you think of any tree like that in the garden? There's a tree like that in the garden. So the lampstand is shaped to be a replica of the tree of life because it's God's presence. And God is, see, the tabernacle is in some ways sort of a replica of the garden. It's not a good one, but it's a start. This is all a temporary project. God's making stages on this, right? So this is at the start. That's how it looked. All of the furniture in the tabernacle was gold, either solid gold or a good gold layer over wood. So that's holy metal. Don't think wealth and luxury and how rich they were. Think of God's presence. And in the New Jerusalem, the whole city is made out of gold, and we walk on a street of gold. The point is not that we're going to be rich. It's that we're walking in the Holy of Holies. We're walking in the very presence of God because everything that was like walking on the ark or walking on the table or the incense altar and so on. Gold is the city of God's presence. Oh, look what I've done to my notes. This is totally illegible. You're skunked, Ed. Well, we'll carry on. I'll be looking a little more closely. I reuse my paper, and in some cases here I have two sets of typing on one side and none on the other. So, let's see what I think. Cube. If you look at the measurements of the tabernacle was 30 cubits long, that's 45 feet. That's roughly the length of this building. And it was 10 cubits wide. That's 15 feet, so it's about half as wide as this room. That's the tabernacle. And the front part, 10 cubits this way, this way and this way is the Holy of Holies. So the Holy of Holies is a cube. God likes that. Where's Malachi? Is he in here? He likes cubes too. He's carrying ones around all the time. God likes the cube. When Solomon built a tabernacle, it was double the size, but it was 20 cubits, 30 feet, 20 cubits, 20 cubits. The New Jerusalem is a cube. It is 12,000 stadia. This way, and this way. It amounts to about 800 miles. But the point is, the whole Jerusalem is a cube, like the Holy of Holies. The whole place is the presence of God. Don't think big cube. Think God's presence. So it's a replica of the tabernacle. And the tabernacle is, in a sense, a little version of the presence of God. And so the presence of God is in the garden, and the tabernacle gives us a 10 cubit cube. And Solomon gave us, his Solomon's temple had a 20 cubit cube. And Revelation gives us a 12,000 stadia cube. It's huge. The point is, it's basically as big as the world was as they understood it at that time. But everything becomes God's dwelling. Don't think cube. Think God's presence. And the whole thing is God's Holy of Holies, which is us, those people there. That's what's going on here. A little bit about how they camped. In Numbers 2, we have this. When they camped with the tabernacle went right in the middle of the camp, and three tribes were listed on the north, three tribes on the north, three on the south, three on the east, and three on the west. And they were named, three tribes on each side, and the tabernacle is right in the middle. It's a picture of God living in the middle of his people. That's where God wanted to be. And when they marched, when they traveled, six tribes would go, one after the other, and they were told in which order. And then the priests and Levites would carry the tabernacle and the furniture, and then the other six tribes would come afterward. So God was, even when they moved, always in the middle of his people. But you see, so you've got these 12 tribes going around, but they can't actually get at God. Okay, they can't go. Ordinary Israelites can never go in the tabernacle. Only the priests can go in to the actual tabernacle. But in the New Jerusalem, there are three gates on each side of the Holy of Holies. And each one has the name of a tribe of Israel on it. And the door is never closed. So anybody can be in God's holy presence anytime they want, day or night. Never, there's no night, so it never gets closed. So the point is that there is complete and free access to God at that point. So this is illustrated, and John in the end of Revelation likes that stuff, and he talks about it. And he's building on something that's been going on in Genesis and Exodus and in Numbers. But all of this is partial, and it's incomplete. It's still preliminary. It's still preliminary, but we're getting ready for the real thing. In the New Testament, because Christ is with us, the main thing that changes is that there's no more structure. So Moses, they built a tabernacle, which is like an elaborate tent. You could take it down and move it. And then once they settled in the Promised Land, Solomon built a temple, and God's house was the structure. God lived in the structure, and his people were all around. And that's good. In the New Testament, it is very clear that the people themselves, we are the temple. There's no structure. The tabernacle is done away. God doesn't need that kind of protection or barrier. There's no temple. The people are the temple. Okay, I want somebody to read. Oh, I can do this. 1 Corinthians 3. So occasionally individuals are the temple, but usually it's the gathering, the community. 1 Corinthians 3. Do you not know that you yourselves are God's temple and that God's Spirit dwells in your midst? He's writing to the Corinthian church. If anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person, for God's temple is sacred and you together are that temple. Now listen, the Corinthian church was not a very good church. They were jerks. There was a lot of sin going on in that church. But if this is true of them, this is true of us. Don't you know, this, imagine God saying this to us. Don't you know that you yourselves at the Kleefeld Christian Community are God's temple? And God by His Spirit dwells in your midst, KCC. And if anyone destroys God's temple, God will destroy that person. For God's temple at KCC is sacred, and you together are that temple. We don't take it this seriously. They didn't at Corinth either. God takes this very seriously. And God feels defensive, and He's actually warning about people who are causing divisions in the church. That's why there's a stern note in this. And you're going around destroying and messing up God's temple, and He has an opinion about that. So be careful. So all of this is still partial. Jesus told quite a few parables about a king or a landowner who goes to a far place, and he's gone a long time, and then he comes back. See, we're living without the Lord. On the one hand, He says, I am with you always. But He also tells stories about He's gone and we're waiting for Him to return. And the Lord is in a sense, He's enthroned. There's always God is here with us, but He's always got, He's got another home. But God's dream home completed. I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride, beautifully dressed for her husband. And a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling is now with the people, and He will dwell with them. They will be His people, and God Himself will be with them and be their God. See, from that point on, there's no separation. There's no throne of God somewhere else. Right now, God's with us, but He has another dwelling. After that, no. The only dwelling God will have will be in the middle of His people. And you and I and that whole great crowd will be His dream house, and we will see His face. And He's working on this. He likes people who love Him and who will stick with Him. He's building His dream home, and there's a lot going on here. We will see His face. Amen. Let's pray.